To the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn, who is vacationing this week. 9 o'clock on Monday is reserved for all things political. We'll talk about the latest political news and review what's happened over the past week. My guest this morning is Patrick Egan, Assistant Professor of Politics and Public Policy at New York University. Good morning, Professor Egan. Okay, I'm not hearing Professor Egan, so. Well, let me give the phone numbers because they're different from what you normally use to connect with Kathleen. You will be calling today the our Madison call-in number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You're a political junkie. You want to comment on the latest political news, whatever it might be. John McCain had some negative comments about President Obama over the weekend. The Cash for Clunkers program appears to be in some sort of difficulty. We've got health care reform legislation to talk about. Late Friday night, Henry Waxman's committee in the House of Representatives finished its work on a party line vote. Some problems popping up for the Democrats within their own party on health care reform. Okay, we have Professor Egan now. Okay, my guest is Patrick Egan, Assistant Professor of Politics and Public Policy at New York University. Welcome, Professor Egan.
Thanks, John. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here because it gets pretty lonely if I don't have a guest.
Well, I'm happy to serve that purpose then.
There was plenty to talk about going into the weekend, and then over the weekend, of course, we had all the TV talk shows yesterday morning and so forth. So lots of political news to talk about. Let's deal with a couple of items that were referred to by Carl Castle in the news at the top of the hour. One is the ongoing saga of the Cash for Clunkers program. And Now it looks like there's some Republican resistance popping up to this. The House approved an additional $2 billion for this program late Friday, and the Senate needs to take it up. But I thought they were in recess until September, so I'm a little confused here.
Yeah, I think it all does get a little confusing. Obviously this is a program that's, in a sense, a victim of its own success, right? It proved wildly popular with buyers, although I think it was really popular with car dealers. And so the promotion of the program, as I'm sure you and all of your listeners saw, was all over the TV and radio, and it just proved much more popular than anyone expected. I think the Republicans are kind of in an interesting bind on this one because, on one hand, I think they're painting it as sort of poor planning by the government, which I think is on point. On the other hand, it's proved a really popular program, and if you tell Americans we're cutting off funding for this thing right in the middle of it, it could actually backfire on the Republican Party.
Well, the criticism this morning was, hey, we've got all this other stuff on our plate. We don't have time to deal with this. We need to slow down. What's the point of that?
Well, to be fair, it's actually pretty easy to just vote another appropriation for a program you already have up and running. So I don't think actually it's all that difficult to get the legislation out there. And this is, one of the criticisms of the whole recovery package from any side of the aisle is that average, ordinary Americans aren't actually seeing any tangible benefits of the vast amount of stimulus money that's being spent by the government. And this is actually one case where a typical middle-class American family can really see some sort of benefit out of this giant stimulus program.
Yeah, and for those of us who got rid of our gas guzzlers a year or two ago, we're feeling kind of bad about that right now. But
yeah, exactly. It's a case of buyer's remorse, I'm sure. It's a strange and I think sort of unusual program. The federal government doesn't do this kind of thing all that often, and it creates kind of very strange market incentives, as we saw with people just lining up to to get rid of their old cars and buy new ones before any kind of deadline or end of funding. So it's not a free market economist dream by any chance, by any means. But at the same time, it's also politically, I think, actually a pretty popular program, and one that, at least my instinct would be, that Democrats and Republicans alike would have more to lose by ending it than lose by, you know, failing to provide additional money.
Well, it certainly didn't take the House long and very long to deal with it. Meanwhile, on the other part of this, maybe a little less pleasant issue for Congress to deal with, is health care reform. Late Friday, Representative Waxman's committee in the House, which was the last committee, I believe, that had to work on health care reform bill, took a party line vote. Actually, I think there were 5 Democrats in that committee who voted against the bill. But this bill cleared its last hurdle before floor debate in the House, and there was quite a bit of compromising that had to be done. Was this a victory for the Obama administration?
I'd say it's a limited victory. You know, all along Obama's been saying, in a sense, and Obama, and more importantly his staff, have been saying, you know, we don't really care how this gets done. We've got a series of principles that we'd like to adhere to, but beyond that, you guys figure out how you want to do it, you know, how you want to meet these goals. And so to that extent, you know, that he gets a bill out of important committees that meet those goals, it is a victory for him. But as everyone's saying, and as everyone knows, this is just the beginning of a very long and I think still uphill climb to get some kind of effective legislation in place by the end of the year.
For the Democrats right now, one of the dangers that they face really is that they're kind of divided on this issue. You've got this group of so-called blue dog Democrats who sometimes act more like Republicans than what most people assume Democrats are.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think there's sort of been a series of things that no one quite thought through that are making this health care vote a difficult one to cast for blue dog Democrats. And let's not forget that a lot of those Democrats come from districts that either went for McCain in 2008 or went very, very narrowly for Obama. Many of them are freshmen, and they're looking at historical patterns, which is that the president's party tends to lose seats in the House in midterm elections. So, you know, all of the odds are stacked against vulnerable Democrats from swing districts. And so these are the representatives that are really loath to be looking too liberal, but I think more to the point, voting for anything that looks like a tax increase. And what you've seen over the last couple of weeks, I think, has been the opponents of health care reform successfully framing it as a tax increase. And the proponents of health care reform haven't really gotten in front of that message to say, to talk realistically about the costs, and more important, about the benefits that this thing could provide to lots of Americans. So they're, you know, the blue dogs are just they're kind of in a tough spot, and a lot of it has to do, I think, with the perception of taxation.
Well, and the those members of the Obama administration who hit the Sunday morning talk show circuit didn't really help that. They continue to refuse to rule out tax increases. And if you look at this objectively from a purely public policy perspective, it's always foolish to rule anything out because you never know what you're going to be faced with. On the other hand, politically, you know, you're supposed to rule out tax increases because that seems to be the litmus test for good government. If anybody even talks about a tax increase, you know, that person is basically taken out and tarred and feathered in the blogosphere and everywhere else.
It's true. I mean, they're refusing to rule out a tax increase because I think it's going to be part of whatever package ends up getting passed. I think it looks like it's pretty difficult to do anything without raising taxes on somebody. If I were advising them, and I shouldn't be, and they shouldn't be asking me to, but I'll give you my opinion, which is that what they really need to do is focus more upon, look, if we don't do anything now, then you get the status quo, which nobody likes. And so to paint opponents of healthcare reform as supporters of the status quo is, I think, the right way to go in terms of turning the debate around in a direction that favors the healthcare reformers. But that's a difficult thing to do.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to get involved in our discussion. It's All Things Political for Monday, the 3rd of August, 2009. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email. The address is talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call first from Jim in Milwaukee. Jim, good morning.
Hi. I'd like to speak as a liberal about how condescending liberals handle health care and other issues, and just start out by saying that I was a treatment social worker in the prison system, and so I, in order to survive, had to learn about con manipulation. But unfortunately, the public at large is never taught that in the school system. And I mention that because Bill Maher was talking about on his show that the cash for clunkers was advantageous to people from Kentucky because then they'd be able to see their front lawns. But that's a classic condescending liberal approach because it characterizes people that are gullible as hillbillies or Eb and Zeb from the South or Hicks from the sticks. But I think we should put the focus in confronting the perpetrators, not the victims of con manipulation. And a couple of con manipulations that are going on in healthcare right now, there are claims being circulated that healthcare will be taken away from whites and given to blacks or other minorities. And the other kind of manipulation is that has a grandma talking to a grandpa and saying, you're not going to be able to get surgery because all the money is going to go into abortion funding. So people have to start focusing on the situation and realize that conservatives make a very good living kind of manipulating people and focus on the situation, not the victims.
Professor?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, this is, particularly with the healthcare reform debate, we're seeing a little bit of a rewind of the stuff that happened in the early 90s, where all kinds of criticisms are coming up about a sweeping proposal to change one-sixth of the American economy. So I think Americans of every stripe, conservative, liberal, moderate, have reason to be worried because we are talking about a very significant change. And also we know... if we look worldwide, American political culture is particularly suspicious of large-scale government activity. As everyone knows, we are, you know, really the only major industrialized nation not to have a national health care program. And one of the reasons why is that it's our political culture. We distrust government, and we think that individuals should be in charge of their own destiny, as it were. And so these sorts of criticisms, as far out of left or right field as they come, I think sort of hit a target with a lot of Americans, and that's why they resonate and they persist.
Well, you go back to Ronald Reagan, you know, the government isn't the solution, it's the problem. I mean, the assumption going forward is that private industry is always more efficient than the government. Private industry does everything better than the government. General Motors and all of the companies that had failed in the last 2 years, notwithstanding, there's this continued chant or mantra almost, the government is bad, we need, you know, the government shouldn't be doing anything. And I guess looking at this from the perspective of someone in the media, what seems to be lacking here is anyone who actually challenges that point of view and says, well, wait a minute. You know, any bureaucracy, I don't care, you know, if it's private enterprise or the government, any bureaucracy is inherently inefficient. And who's to say which one is better or worse?
Yeah, I agree. You point out that it's a very interesting moment in American political and economic history where I think a lot of sort of the free market promise is really come into question more than we have probably in the last 20 or 30 years. And I think the key is for Obama and proponents of healthcare reform to really kind of seize upon that. You know, we also have all this data showing, for example, that Medicare is run much more efficiently than a lot of the private companies that are also running Medicare. So there's sort of a lot of reasons to if you're on the side of government provided healthcare to call for it. And I think right now, for one reason or another, you're not seeing those kinds of arguments out there. So I would definitely agree with you, John, that kind of thing could be more put forward right now.
All right, it's All Things Political for this Monday morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. And I know that this health care issue is going to continue to come up through the hour, and we'll continue to take those calls and discuss it and try and weave some other things in amongst that and see how this all works out. Lots to talk about. It's August recess for Congress. What are they going to hear from their constituents when they get home? I'll throw this out to our listeners. If you run into your member of Congress on this recess, what are you going to talk to them about? What are you going to ask them? What questions would you have if you could be sitting down with your senator or your representative? What would you ask them about? What would you want to talk about? South Carolina Governor Sanford in the news again. This time it's about email. We talked about cash for clunkers. John McCain had some harsh words for the Obama administration. There's the ongoing saga of Sarah Palin and lots of other stuff to talk about in political news. 800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I'll be right back. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 23 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. On a typical day, one-third of Americans take a nap, more men than women, especially over 50. At issue with Ben Marins after 5, a look at the latest Who's Napping study from the Pew Center for Social and Demographic Trends. That's after 5 today. Please try and stay awake until then. And after that, for that matter. This hour, it's All Things Political as we sort through the various political news stories over the last week and particularly over the weekend. Lots going on, lots to talk about, and we have lots of callers as well. And we'll get back to the phones. Let me reintroduce my guest. Patrick Egan is Assistant Professor of Politics and Public Policy at New York University. He's on the phone with me, and so is Richard in Madison. Richard, good morning.
Hi. I want to know your guest's opinion on why the Democrats seem to have fallen into a trap with health care reform. Time is on the side of reformers. The employer-based health care system is falling apart. Yet they've said we've got to make all the changes this year or something terrible is going to happen. And they're about to sign on to a terrible deal where they hand the health insurance industry mandatory health care, which means money all transferred to the private sector. In return, they're getting very weak subsidies and no public option. Why have they defined it this way? There's no need to sign a bad deal now, and the changes that they're getting aren't going to go in effect for 3 or 4 years anyway.
To respond to that, I think the final verdict is still out about exactly what the final version of healthcare will look like, or if any healthcare reform will look like. And so, one thing that could happen is we see a very narrow passage of a bill that only has Democrats on board come the fall. And I would imagine that bill would look a little bit more on the liberal side than the kinds of components that Richard just mentioned. The other direction that may happen that looks less and less likely is something that is supported by a bipartisan coalition. And I think what's the reason why Democrats, and particularly Obama, is allowing these kinds of concessions is that I think politically they think they have more to gain by looking bipartisan and by getting Republican votes than by ramming something through that only has Democratic votes. Now, that still may happen because, it seems like every day you hear another Republican telling Americans that, you know, they're sort of pulling out. They're not interested in the kinds of conversations that are happening. But my sense is that the Obama folks think that they have a lot to gain by continuing a bipartisan dialogue for as long as they can. And if it goes through, great. And if it breaks down, then they'll probably end up with something that looks a lot more liberal than the kinds of things we're seeing right now.
Richard, thanks for the call. Professor, what's the Republican health care plan?
Well, that's the thing. It's not much of anything. There is one plan that's been signed on to by, Lindsey Graham and some others that has some of the components that have been talked about, but obviously doesn't have a public plan, makes it a little bit harder for typical Americans to get coverage. And I think that is, as we've been saying, that rejoinder is probably the strongest one that proponents of health care plan and Democrats have to those who say we shouldn't do anything, which is to say, well, if you don't have a plan, then you're for the status quo. And nobody likes the status quo, you know, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or independent. And so that seems to be the very powerful message that keeps this whole conversation alive.
Well, I guess one of the interesting things about this, and we do need to move on and take some other issues, but one of the interesting things about this is that the health care insurance companies are actually in favor of some sort of reform, because what they see happening is as the plans become too expensive, more and more companies and people are just dropping out of the system, and so they make less money.
Right. And I think, you know, that's the thing, is that typically what's happening is that the opponents of reform are targeting folks who have health insurance, who may not love their health insurance, but certainly have something that provides for basic needs, et cetera. And they're saying, look, under the new plan, you're going to have something worse. And the proponents of health care reform are saying, look, nothing's going to change to your current plan, and to those who have no coverage or very limited coverage, you're going to get something better. And, you know, the word is kind of out exactly what, or the jury's out in terms of what would actually happen under a new plan. But those tend to be the basic framing arguments of both sides.
Well, let's kind of switch topics here. Let's go to Stephen in Fish Creek next. Stephen, good morning.
Hey, I'm listening to a new hit song. It's called We Must Audit the Fed. I'm wondering why nobody's talking about Ron Paul's bill in Congress. 282 members of the House of Representatives have signed onto it, and 20 senators saying that we want transparency in the Federal Reserve banking system. Let's get the secrets out into the public eye and see what's going on here, because the dollar has sunk 95% of its value under the Federal Reserve's control. When do we have some idea what these people are doing in secret? Talk about it, please.
That's a really interesting topic, and I'm not aware of Ron Paul's bill, so I won't speak about those details. But you're getting at an interesting question that a lot of political scientists have thought about, which is how independent and transparent a central bank should be. One of the problems with making what central bankers do more open to the public is that they then therefore become, in theory, more pressured by the public. And there's a lot of sort of theory out there that says a lot of times you don't want a central banker who's too responsible, too responsive to the public, because then the bank won't pursue policies that may be painful in the short term but beneficial in the long term. And so this bill and the caller have kind of stepped into this very interesting, not just political but academic debate about the independence of central banks from political pressure.
Gary and Holton is up next. Gary, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, Honduras, there was a coup d'etat there last month, democratically elected Miguel Zelaya, and our Secretary of State has called him reckless. He's trying to get back into his proper seat as the Organization of American States. And I'm not getting any response from my senators and representatives. I've called and written. And that's why I'd like to meet them over the break and have their words on this, please.
Hey, what about it? What about the situation in Honduras? And what do you think the proper role of members of Congress would be? Should they be commenting on this, do you think?
Sure. It's certainly within the proper role of elected federal officials to comment on foreign policy. The administration is a little bit of a bind here, because it's not entirely clear how popular this guy is who was ousted in the coup. So in his home country. So if for example, if a referendum were to be held about whether he should be returned to office, my sense is, from the reporting I've read, is that he would probably lose such a referendum. Now, in a democracy, typically somebody gets the chance to serve out their full term, and that hasn't happened there. So the interesting question here is, do you stand for the principles of democracy, which is what the United States has been on record as supporting, at least recently, or do you just sort of say, we're not going to interfere in the internal affairs of another country and sort of let them work it out as long as things don't get too crazy? So that, it's one of these sort of low-profile, low-salience kinds of cases, and my guess is that the main thing that's happening here is that on the foreign policy front, the administration has a lot more bigger fish to fry at the moment.
Thanks for the call, Gary. Let's go next to Daryl in Couderay. Good morning, Daryl.
Good morning, gentlemen. I heard this story on Democracy Now! Last week, and the story is about the domestic spying by the United States Army through a civilian contractor so the Army can sidestep the Posse Comitatus Act. This happened in Olympia, Washington, and according to information gotten through the Freedom of Information Act, it was discovered that a member of an anti-war peace group that has been protesting the Iraq war admitted he was doing the spying and that he was contracting through the United States Army.
Wow.
Pretty intense stuff.
That's pretty scary. Had you heard anything? I didn't catch the Democracy Now! Report, but I did have a note from my producer saying, yeah, it was on there. And what do you think? I mean, that's kind of frightening, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I haven't heard anything about this myself, but certainly we're aware of kind of a broader sense of domestic surveillance activities that may or may not be legal, and were pursued in lots of under lots of different ways in the Bush administration, and who knows to what extent that stuff is continuing in the current administration. And you know, the caller has sort of gotten into this murky world of defense contractors that are the line between sort of official action by employees of the United States government and employees of companies that have been hired by the government has gotten very, very blurry. We've seen that in Iraq. We've seen that with say prison maintenance and oversight. And now, if this is true, we're seeing it both domestically as well. It'll be interesting to see if this story catches more fire.
Well, and you also had the story of Thomas Tam, who's working as he was working as an attorney in the Justice Department's Office of Intelligence Policy and Review. He decided to become a whistleblower and tell the public about the spying program, and that's essentially wrecked his life. So, you know, there's still a lot going on here, and there's probably quite a bit more that we don't know about.
I think that's true, and you know, it's probably always the case that there's a lot of things we don't know about that that the government is doing. And then the question becomes, is there the proper oversight by Congress to ensure that the things that stay secret are still legal? And my sense is that that system really kind of got broken down over the last 5 or 6 years and is in some need of repair.
Daryl, thanks for that call, and keep your eyes open on that one, and let us know if what else you find out. Andrew in Ashland will be next. Andrew, good morning.
Oh, hi. I had to laugh. I think the professor said that he thought Medicare was more efficient than private companies in some instances, and I don't know if he's aware, but former U.S. Comptroller David Walker came out with a report a couple years ago explaining how Social Security and Medicare combined represent $54 trillion in unfunded liabilities. I mean, the idea that the government is somehow more efficient than the private sector is a laugh, because they can just create money. They can create debt. Private companies actually have to balance their books. I mean, and to think that we're now talking about creating a new unfunded liability in the form of Obamacare, what a joke. I mean, does that not comprehend with people that we cannot afford to take on something that would represent a $1 trillion in new debt?
Well, let me ask
you
then.
An important distinction, and the caller is calling me to task with my language, and I'll agree and disagree. Which is, in terms of efficiency, I'm using that term to mean the ability to deliver services at low cost and high quality. And many studies, actually, including by the GAO, have shown that in terms of Medicare and actually Social Security, the administrative cost of those programs per unit of service delivered is much, much lower than in the private sector. And that a lot of that has to do with economies of scale, because the government is such a bigger provider. Now, however, the caller does bring up a an important question, which I wouldn't put under the aegis of efficiency. I would say has to more to do with spending and saving, which is this something that we can afford? And that is a much bigger question. And we do have a lot of unfunded liabilities in these big government programs. Chances are, further government work in the healthcare industry would result in additional liabilities. And so that is another story altogether, which is I think it's fair to say that current government programs tend to be a little bit more efficient at delivering healthcare than the private sector. But if you increase the amount of government activity in the healthcare sector, what are we doing in terms of long-term debt? And that's a totally fair question.
I guess the other thing, though, is when we hear about, okay, this is a $1 trillion program, but it's over 10 years, and if you look at how much is projected to be spent in this country over the next 10 years on health care, the government program would be a small fraction of that.
I think that's right, and I think, you know, it all depends on how you're balancing these books, right? Because then there's also, on the other side of the ledger, all of the costs that are associated with lack of health care, including administrative costs, but more important, you know, delayed procedures, all kinds of other things that end up being costly because we don't have sort of a comprehensive health care safety net. And so it really depends on who's balancing the books, who's doing the math in terms of what the costs are. But I think it's fair to say that what would happen under such a system is that the government would assume more of these costs, perhaps with the benefit of reducing them, but that the liabilities for these funds would fall under the government and ultimately taxpayers. So it's, you know, nothing comes for free, but at the same time, you may be getting something that's pretty good.
Well, and we need to move on because we've got a lot of other callers. And let me give the phone numbers again, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also reach us via email, talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call next from Ron in Sparta. Ron, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. You said earlier, get active with your legislator. Well, there was a meeting in La Crosse Saturday morning with Russ Feingold. A very small blurb in the paper the day before was the only reason, and actually my wife searched out the time. I don't think it was publicized very extensively because at 7:30 on Saturday morning is a hard time to draw a crowd. However, there were 200-plus people in the city hall there to speak to Mr. Feingold, and he commented on everybody's question. Mine was in relation to the oils, futures, and commodities, that how they falsely inflated the price by double last year and what it did to our economy and how they're going to get that under control, and also the disability appeals of veterans. It surpassed 1 million sitting on the shelf waiting for an answer, of which I'm one.
And what was the senator's response on the disability question?
They'd look into it.
Well, that's good. I guess that's actually a pretty safe thing to say if you're in office. I'm impressed that 200 folks turned out that early in the morning to talk to their senator. But knowing Wisconsin's progressive and participatory tradition, I'm not too surprised. It's good to hear that. That many people are interested and willing to show up. And Feingold, I think, has a pretty good rep for making himself accessible to constituents, although a meeting at that time in the morning with little publicity is probably not to his credit.
he's a pretty popular guy. I think he draws a crowd in Wisconsin pretty much wherever he shows up.
There you go.
So let's see. Let's take a call next from Jim in Milwaukee. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good so far, but it's only 20 minutes to 10, so
okay.
I have to leave some room for, you know, things to happen.
All right. Let's make something happen on the payday loan bill that's going on in the state legislature this week. This bill would limit the interest rate cap on payday loans, okay? As it is now, there is no limit. These finance companies can charge up to 400 or 500% interest on the loans that they make. It's a disgrace in Wisconsin. And the only thing that keeps them in business is a lobbyist that they can put together on this issue. What's your guess think on that?
Well, you know, I don't know much about the provisions of this local bill, since I'm here in New York, but I think it's part of an interesting trend that we see in Washington and across the country, and this goes back a little bit to an earlier conversation we had, which is that the government has become more aggressive at regulating private sector business. So you're seeing, we're already seeing the effects of a bill passed by Congress earlier in the year to regulate credit card interest rates, and it's not too much of a stretch to say that that is all part of a continuum from credit cards to payday loans of ways to charge Americans high interest rates for loans that perhaps they need. And for the longest time, the sort of mantra has been, you know, let the market dictate where these rates should fall. People can make rational decisions about the kinds of loans they're going to take, just let it go from there. And what you're really seeing, I think, right now is a backlash to that, and it sounds like this bill is one example.
Well, the payday loan bill in Wisconsin, the genesis of that. These payday loan companies have popped up on street corners all over the last 10 years plus, and you go in, and if you can prove you have a paycheck, you can give them a check and they'll hold it for 2 weeks and then charge you a certain amount of money based on how big the check is you ask them to hold.
Sure.
You know, in the old days, you might have done that with your mother, only she didn't charge you any interest. And now you're going and people were getting into serious trouble with these things, and they weren't regulated at all. And there were a number of mayors I know, including one Republican mayor in Wisconsin who were not happy with these companies and wanted something done, and the state legislature is now responding to that. It seems to be, I think, a sort of a bipartisan thing in Wisconsin. It's easy for everybody to beat up on the payday loan companies.
Well, again, that's interesting because essentially what those bills are saying is that there are people who walk into these businesses who can't make rational choices for themselves, right? So somebody, in theory, should be able to say, "Gosh, they're going to charge me 500% interest. This isn't worth it." But what government is saying with these kinds of bills, and this is also true with the credit card industry, is that the government should ask a little bit more, like a nanny. You know, as we talk about the nanny state, sort of making sure that people are making decisions that are in their best interest, and that's a very different philosophy than the laissez-faire philosophy that's ruled, I think, has been in the spotlight over the last 20 years.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have more with Professor Egan and our callers. Here is your phone number. Boy, I'm having a flashback to old days. 800-642-1234 is the phone number to use to reach this program today. 800-642-1234. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. It's 9:46. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up next hour. Recently, online merchant Amazon.com abruptly deleted books from users' Kindle wireless reading devices when the company discovered the books had been improperly published. Next hour, my guest and I will ponder whether the practice of deleting content from individual electronic reading devices could signal a new era of censorship. That's coming up after the news at 10 o'clock. This hour, it's All Things Political. My guest is Patrick Egan, Assistant Professor of Politics and Public Policy at New York University. Let's take a call next from Mark in Milwaukee.
Yes, thank you. Let's talk about the difficulty it is to acquire health insurance in America and the fact that the real problem is if you have any kind of catastrophic illness, if anything happens to you and you can't get health care, you lose everything that you've worked all your life for. That, to me, is not the definition of freedom and or the American idea of wanting to be in charge of their own destinies. And the greater issue is the millions upon millions of people that are in my situation where they will lose everything if anything happens to them. We do not have basic health care or access to health care, lots of us, and I am one of them.
Yeah, I think, you know, your story is exactly the kind of story that needs to be told a little bit more strongly by proponents of health care reform right now. I think reminding Americans who are, you know, one step away from medical bankruptcy, that, you know, this plan would really change that, I think is part of the very strong argument that they can make. And we're in this, this, you know, pickle right now where a lot of folks who would have been able to file for bankruptcy in under previous bankruptcy rules now are in a bind under the new, much more strict bankruptcy rules. And so the, there are a lot of stories out there that I think could be used to counter the arguments being made by the opponents of healthcare reform. And for one reason or another, those stories just aren't sort of at the top of the media pile right now. And I think that would be a good idea to, for the proponents of healthcare reform to change that.
Jim in River Falls, you're up next this morning. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
With regard to the health insurance thing, I can just say that I have health insurance and have had health insurance almost all my adult life. But the fights I have to go through with sometimes to get them to pay the bills, that's wasted productive time on my part. I generally get them to pay, but it's a war. And I think that's something that the proponents of the for-profit health insurance thing aren't talking about either. But my point is, we talked. I'm against the current plan. I think single payer is the only way to go. France is number one. We're number 37. That means they're doing something right and we're doing something wrong. But the money part, you know, we spent $1 trillion bailing out Bear Stearns, AIG, the banks, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and nobody was up in arms about that. They say the final tally for the Iraq war is going to be close to $2.6 trillion. But the only thing we seem to hear out is, oh, this going into debt for health care. And I just wanted to hear your perspective on, you know, where do we spend our money? If we're going to banks and we're going to spend it on wars, or we're going to spend it on giving health care to the American people?
Right. I think, you know, the out party, whether they were the Democrats under Bush or the Republicans under Obama, typically become much more interested in deficit and debt reduction when they're out of power than when they're in power and they're making the policy. And so the kinds of refrains you're hearing from Republicans right now are somewhat similar to the ones that you heard from Democrats about the Iraq war and other big programs undertaken by Bush.
Well, or the Bush tax cuts.
That's right. Exactly. And I think, you know, but it also speaks to sort of a broader issue, which is that if the economy were currently in better shape, or if people were more confident that it was getting into better shape, I think that the revenue and fiscal aspects of this program would be a lot less salient. You know, Americans have the sense in their own households that they need to save more, they need to spend less, and that they're on a financial precipice. And I think they rightly or wrongly think that about the federal government as well, that we tend to think about you know, government policy in pretty simple terms, and those are the ones that make sense to a lot of us right now. And all of the, it just brings the cost of this program into sort of higher relief than it would be if we were in a healthy economy.
Thanks for that call. Appreciate it. Let me give the phone number again because we have a line that's just opened up, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, and you can communicate with us either way, 800-642-1234 or talk@WPR.org. Bob in Marshfield, you're next. Good morning,
Hi.
Bob.
Hi. It strikes me that the conservatives aren't paying attention. If the Europeans are paying 9 or 10% of GDP for health care, we're paying 18. Guess who is going to sell more automobiles, airplanes, and MRIs?
Exactly. I mean, and I think the proponents of healthcare reform were gaining a lot of steam early in the debate by recasting healthcare reform as something good for the economy. You know, I think previous proponents had Clinton had really focused on the ability of a new program to help out those who didn't have access to health care. And the change in direction that we saw under Obama was really focusing on your point, which is that there's a big economic impact of this big inefficient healthcare system we have now that could perhaps be improved under a new system. And again, that story has also gotten lost in the current debate. And all of this is sort of redoubling my sense that the proponents need to kind of get their message better under control and get these kinds of arguments out there again into the world, I guess.
Well, they need to agree on what the truth is. I mean, right now, you know, you've got so many different people coming from so many different angles, the message just sort of gets lost in all the clutter. There was the famous example of and I don't remember which Japanese automaker it was, if it was Toyota or Honda or who, deciding to locate their plant in Canada because healthcare costs were so much less.
That's right.
So we lost out on a factory and a whole bunch of jobs. And, you know, people think, well, you know, we're going to spend a lot of tax dollars to get this healthcare reform done. And the argument on the other side is, well, wait a minute. If we can have more people employed because companies will actually set up factories here and do business here, then they'll all be paying taxes. And so the burden is actually less for everybody. But those kind of arguments get kind of abstract and they don't fit well on a bumper sticker.
Yeah, that's right. And to be fair to the folks who are trying to get this done in Washington, when you have a whole lot of different proposals on the table, it's also hard to fashion a really consistent message. And so perhaps that will be seen once there's a specific proposal that is before both houses of Congress. Then, you know, one sense I have is that Obama can't talk specifically about stuff because there aren't specifics yet available. And once they are, we may be seeing more of a consistent message.
Here's an email from Jeff. He says, can your guest comment on the traction, legalization, and taxation of marijuana is getting in California? I understand there are ads airing on television promoting the idea, and the proposal is getting serious consideration in the cash-strapped state. What is the likelihood of this idea catching on in other states if it becomes successful in California?
That's an interesting question. I wasn't aware of that particular phenomenon in California.
Well, Oakland just...
Let me say the one thing I do know about this, which is that American public opinion on marijuana use has actually been remarkably stable over the last 20 or 30 years in terms of the proportion of Americans who think that marijuana should be legal. It's pretty low. It's in the 20s or 30s, I think.
And the rest of them didn't inhale, is that it?
Well, and it's also, you know, there's tremendous, the opinion is tremendously varies with age. So you see younger people being more liberal about this and older people less so. But the interesting thing is it looks like people's opinions do become more conservative as they get older.
The city of Oakland just passed a tax on marijuana, I believe it was. I saw that over the weekend, and California was actually considering this as a way to balance their budget. I mean, they've got medical marijuana is legal there, and they've been battling with the federal government over that. But they're looking, people are using this stuff. We might as well be making some money on it because we don't want to have to increase income taxes.
Right, and so it's interesting. I wonder if the idea is that you would be, if you were caught purchasing this stuff illegally, you would then, in addition to whatever fine and sentence you serve, you'd also have to pay taxes on it. I'm not quite sure how it works.
Yeah, I'm not. How do you it's like taxing gambling. Anyway, let's take a call from Jody in Milwaukee next. And Jody, we're almost out of time, so please be brief.
Hi, I am an owner of a small business. I employ 12 part-time people, and I also have fibromyalgia, which is an autoimmune disease. And having talked to people throughout the world who have what people would call socialized medicine here, they are getting much better care than I can get here. We've already had to declare bankruptcy once because of my medications and my medical problems, and we need a single-payer health plan so that I can get the medical help I need and keep working.
Again, another powerful story that not only speaks to the effectiveness of any healthcare reform in terms of delivering services, but gets at the economic impact of the current system as well.
John McCain criticized the Obama administration over the weekend for what he says is a lack of bipartisanship on healthcare. Any surprise there?
No, I think the road that we appear to be heading down is probably a healthcare reform plan that's mostly Democrats, and perhaps all Democrats. And so you're going to see folks like McCain and other Republicans throughout the summer criticizing Democrats for lack of bipartisanship.
Is there some risk for them in doing that?
I don't think there's a risk in criticizing them for lack of bipartisanship, but there is a risk for them in looking like they're not trying to solve the problem. And maybe that's what you're getting at, John. This is almost a preemptive attack to kind of ward off the accusations that the Republicans didn't do anything. Is that they're arguing, well, we're not being invited to be involved,
which
I think is not quite accurate at the moment.
We'll have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much, Professor, for helping us out today.
Yeah, it was good to be here.
My guest this hour was Patrick Egan, Assistant Professor of Politics and Public Policy at New York University. If you missed part of the program, want to hear the beginning of it, you can go to our website, WPR.org, and listen to the whole thing all over again. Rhonda Fanning produced this hour. Brittany DeAnda and Bill Martins did on-air production duties. Thanks for all their help. We'll be back to talk about whether we're headed for 1984 or Fahrenheit 451 after the news. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network.